Okay. Hello, everyone. Hi. Good evening, and welcome to the North Dakota Medical Association's Wednesday weekly webinar. We're back. Welcome back. My name is Courtney Coble. I'm Executive Director of the North Dakota Medical Association, and on behalf of NDMA, thank you all for attending. And thanks for your participation and membership with NDMA. I have an announcement to start off things about our annual meeting. At last council meeting, they decided in light of COVID-19 to hold the annual meeting virtually. It'll be on a Wednesday, like our webinars, in early October. Stay tuned for details, but we think it's going to be a unique opportunity and we have a lot of great ideas. And so we're looking forward to that in the fall. In COVID news, NDMA sent a letter last week to our congressional delegation expressing our support of two bills filed regarding immigrant visas. We've got the details in our e-physician, but it's a bipartisan act that will help ensure that the thousands of foreign-born nurses and physicians overseas who want to practice in the United States are given the opportunity to do so. This act will authorize the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services to recapture up to 25,000 visas for nurses and 15,000 immigrant visas for physicians. This act would also allow the recapture of visas for families of these medical professionals. It's important to know with this bill, though, is that it would not create more visas. Rather, it would simply reallocate the limited number of unused visas from prior years. Senator Kramer is a co-sponsor of the Senate version. NDMA also committed to a sign-on letter to Congress about including targeted and limited liability protections for physicians in the next national and the federal COVID-19 package working its way through Congress right now. If you remember, a couple weeks ago, NDMA brought this issue to our governor's attention, and so we're going to continue to pursue that issue on a state level, but now it's reached a federal level. One final bit of information, the North Dakota Department of Health recently hired a new state forensic examiner to replace Dr. Macello. Her name is Barry Miller and she starts on July 1st. That's all I have for now, but let's get to our panelists. Tonight's panelists are Joan Connell, our North Dakota Department of Health Field Medical Officer. She leads the North Dakota Department of Health Physician Advisory Group and will share the latest COVID-19 news. And then I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. Andrew Stahl. He was appointed the Interim State Health Officer by Governor Burgum last week. And prior to his appointment, he was providing strategic medical analysis for the Unified Command response efforts in North Dakota. Dr. Stahl is a UND School of Medicine graduate and Bismarck Century graduate, I understand, and he completed his residency at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Prior to coming back to North Dakota, he practiced at the St. Cloud VA healthcare system. Welcome, Dr. Stahl. After the presentations, we'll have opportunity for open discussion, as usual. Please type your question in the question box, and if necessary, you will be unmuted to present your question or discussion topic. So I will hand it over to Dr. Connell. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Courtney. Thanks for the great job you do. So at the Physician Advisory Group meeting last week, Thursday, we actually had a number of things on our agenda. The first thing that we discussed was the update on the Battelle system that's used for N95 respirator decontamination. That is up and running. They're looking for more business. Tim Weidrick also updated us that he has a reliable order in on 3M N95 masks, which will hopefully be available in the next several weeks to refill our depleting medical cash. So that's really, really exciting news. The next thing on the agenda was the remdesivir criteria that had been established for use by North Dakotans by the Physician Advisory Group. And we decided we would reassess this regularly to make sure that we were modifying to keep up with what is needed by North Dakotans. And we learned that many of the patients weren't able to get the remdesivir because our criteria were too strict. So we recommended decreasing the comorbidity of age to at least 50 years old, down from 75, and for changing the oxygen requirement from less than or equal to 88% to less than 94%. So we're hoping those criteria will be implemented, which will increase access by patients. The third item was the outpatient oxygen monitoring protocol that Dr. Dwelly and I designed based on New York models that were ruralized. And what goes with that protocol is a continuous monitoring device. So we hadn't really heard much about that. As you know, the rates of COVID have been decreasing. So, you know, is this project really necessary, at least right now? So in the interim, one of Mylan's last encounters with me was to authorize pursuing those, obtaining a continuous monitoring device. So people are looking into that. I'm not sure if we'll proceed with that plan or not. The next thing on the agenda was the North Dakota Department of Health testing criteria, and I think maybe late Thursday you guys may have received a HON about this, but we were really pleased because one of the subgroups of the physician advisory group is a surgical leads group, which was formed initially just to let leaders in surgery from around the state get together and problem solve their issues of opening back up. And in the first meeting, we were really overwhelmed by the dramatic bottleneck that testing was holding over the ability to open up elective surgeries. So we wrote a letter about that and shared it with testing leadership. And nicely, the testing guidance was revised, now authorizing pre-op testing as part of the state functions for testing. So that was exciting. Other criteria that was modified was being able to test asymptomatic close contacts, preferably 7 to 10 days after exposure. And then also testing pregnant women upon delivery. There's a lot of additional information in that, Han, so make sure if you didn't see it that you look at it. One of the other recommendations we had made as a physician advisory group was to include a section for special populations on the North Dakota Department of Health coronavirus website. And we've been making that recommendation after getting lots of requests from our special populations, particularly Family Voices of North Dakota and the Developmental Disability Consortium, as well as elderly populations. And so those changes were made to the website. And you have to kind of look for it, but they're there now, and there's information and hopefully more information coming soon. Finally, things that were kind of batted back and forth were plans for serology testing. And the physician advisory group had a lot of ideas about that and made some recommendations. The other thing that we talked about is adequate amounts of testing, and particularly with this pre-op testing opportunity. So Kelly Nagel was in on the call, and she was going to help us make sure that she had pre-op testing kits available for all of the local public health areas that might be doing pre-op testing for our patients who are coming into the major hospitals for surgery. And then finally, just so everyone knows about this, there is a point of care antigen test that is now available, produced by SOFIA, S-O-F-I-A. Dr. Carson shared information about this. And it really sounds like it might be useful for a screening test in areas of low prevalence, which we certainly qualify for now, because the negative predictive value will be quite good in those situations. So I would just want everybody to know about that. There was a lot of excitement and buzz in the physician advisory group when that was discussed. So those were kind of the main points from the physician advisory group. As you know, we said goodbye to Mylynn Tufte at the health department and hello to Dr. Andrew Stahl. So the health department has been busy with those changes and we're trying to get settled in. So that's been added to some of the busyness this week. We've also identified some upcoming risks that I think we as physician providers need to be really thoughtful of. And I think some of us are already aware of the concern for declining immunization and screening rates and figuring out how to address those aggressively now before there's a second surge, if there will be a second surge. And also the models that are being shown from other parts of the country regarding the likely sequence of behavioral health fallout after the stress and trauma of the initial pandemic. So I think as far as forward movement for the physician advisory group and forward movement for all the advocates for the North Dakota Medical Association, we really need to put some thought into this and come up with some really good responses that we can share with our patients, that we can work with our state and local health departments in optimizing care for our citizens. And then finally, I just wanted to say thank you, NDMA, and I wanted to say happy anniversary to my husband. It's our 26th year anniversary this evening, and right about now, we were saying our vows, and Mike was really nervous, and he kept saying, do we go up there now? Do we? I can't think of a place I can maybe think of a couple places I'd rather be than here with my NDMA, but only two with my NDMA friends and colleagues. And you know, for 26 years of marriage, that's been, it's been blissful for most of it, but it's also been hard work. And that makes me think of my physician colleagues as well. So I want to thank you guys for your commitment to patients and for North Dakota Health. And I also want to encourage you to really advocate for this organization. North Dakota Medical Association is a place where we can come together, where we can build on each other's strengths. And now more than ever, we need each other to be the best physicians we can be and the healthiest physicians we can be. So please, if you're not a member, consider, if you are a member, drag your friends and colleagues in, because the more of us there are, I think the better we can take care of North Dakotans. Thanks. And I'm available for questions.
Thank you so much, Joan. We had a comment here in our room that we need 1,000 Jones in NDMA. So thank you very much for all your support. And happy anniversary to you and Mike. You know, I wanted to make a couple comments on Joan's points. Number one is that our e-physician going out tomorrow morning will be giving more detail about that test that you talked about that everybody's excited about. And so we're going to have a lot of relevant information that we're discussing tonight in that e-physician. And so I'd like to thank Joan for bringing that to our attention. We have a question. Oh, Jane Winston says happy 26. Yeah. We're all a big family here. So let's see. Anything else? No, dismiss. All right. Well, okay, I will hand it over to you, Dr. Stahl, and you can let us know some of your background and other stuff. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me here. I just wanted to have an opportunity to introduce myself. And first off, Joan and Mike, I want to wish you a happy 26th anniversary. I'm originally from Bismarck, North Dakota. After I finished high school, I joined the Army, served as an infantryman for 9 years, ultimately. I got out and went to school at NDSU, where I graduated with a political science degree. But through my time in the service, realized that medicine was a route I ultimately wanted to go. So I went to University of North Dakota. I graduated under the guidance of Dr. Nguyen, who is now one of my mentors as I enter this new phase. And started initially at Emory University and then ultimately finished my residency at University of Iowa. I worked at the VA hospital, in the hospital as well as in the emergency department at the Iowa City VA. And then I worked in a private practice hospitalist group for several years before my wife, who finished her fellowship in pathology, at which point we picked up and moved to St. Cloud, Minnesota. So we had just finished about a year in St. Cloud, Minnesota before the activation request came for COVID-19 response. So I've been here since about March, working with the members of the Unified Command to develop a way that would be the best step forward for the state of North Dakota. It's never in my wildest dreams would I expect that I would be in this particular position now. It is probably going to be the most challenging thing that I have confronted. I would like to back up and just kind of talk about what I've experienced so far through this whole process. The Department of Health is an amazing group of people here, and they've really stepped up to the game. We have about 205 employees that a lot of them shifted their regular jobs to do at the end of the day so that they could help respond to the COVID fight during the day. So essentially a lot of them were working many hours throughout the day, 16 plus hours, and doing that almost every day. When we first got here, when the lab was starting to run COVID-19 samples, we were running 195 a day. And through significant resource management, we've gotten up to, as of today, 4,190 tests a day capable. It's been an incredible thing to see the relationship between the local public health departments, the National Guard, and the Department of Health as we've moved through this. To speak to the Quidel Sophia 2, for example, I did place a purchase order for 5 of those machines so that we can see how they are actually going to function. They do have an excellent negative predictive value, as was mentioned, up to about a 20% prevalence. We figured would be about the time as to which it would probably lose some of its value. But we're certainly nowhere near that in the state of North Dakota at this time. So I think we probably have some valuable input. And in particular, the negative predictive value and coupled with the PCR is almost exclusive. There's lots of things that we're learning in this process, to include about to look at testing wastewater for PCR samples so we can see what it looks like in the communities, but also in our congregate living settings and in the prison system, for example. There's incredible opportunity at this point in time. The future of the Department of Health is one of the other visions that I would like to speak to. If there's one thing that we've learned during this whole process, is that the Department of Health needs to grow in order to be responsive to the state of North Dakota. And we're going to have to work very hard to ensure that that message is brought forth. I just don't foresee that we'll be able to deal with an influenza or a possible resurgence of this in the near future. So we need to advocate for this department to grow to be responsive to the state of North Dakota. And that's my vision that I am working towards as we move on in the next several months. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there's any that should come up.
All right, I'll open it up. Thanks, Dr. Stahl. This is very interesting. And we're getting two doctors with the Stahl family too. That's yay. Does anyone have any questions? One of the things that I had it on my questions as we're waiting is how that you and Dr. Nguyen are gonna work together.
Right, so Dr. Nguyen and I met this morning to discuss what's the best step forward and what do we create? In other words, he's going to assist our department with developing that division or that vision and the collaboration needed as we move forward and to help us really see what our needs are moving forward.
All right, thanks. I know I have a meeting with Dr. Nguyen on Friday, so he's trying to reach out and so we'll learn more too about his vision. You talked a little bit about the testing that you've helped the state do. How about maybe talk to the listeners about what the testing of the state, some people I see some complaints are that we aren't doing enough testing in Fargo. What's the overall vision there of the governor for the testing?
So right now there's actually several forces that are applied. So for example, there's guidance from the federal level about testing. And then there's what's probably right and appropriate for the state of North Dakota. Within the Fargo-Cass area, we've actually allocated a significant portion of our daily testing supplies to them. And now with our Hologic Panthers coming online, we're able to further expand that even more. In discussions with Dr. Redfield from the CDC and pulling together national live line data that's coming in, we're able to realize that we probably even need to go further beyond in adjusting what actually constitutes or qualifies for being eligible for a test. What is in some literatures referred to as active case finding. Other literatures make it synonymous with surveillance, but we know that about 44% of individuals will either transmit this virus in the asymptomatic stage or pre-symptomatic stage. So that infector-infectee relationship makes it very challenging to monitor this in comparison to, for example, SARS-1, where the time as to which you became symptomatic was also the time that you were shedding the virus. So the isolation period at that time would work if you develop symptoms. It's not working in this case. So by the time we actually identify an outbreak, so to speak, we're already almost a week behind.
Hey, Courtney, can Mike ask a question?
Of course.
With the high prevalence of asymptomatic transmission, is there any focus on testing all the healthcare workers? I ask because I work in the hospital every day and, we protect ourselves from unknown status patients when we have them in urgently or emergently, but nobody has gone through and tested any of the workers. And I just find that an interesting concept that we route patients all through the hospital and have no idea what our own status are. So is there any plan, especially, we're doing it in the nursing homes for all the nursing home providers and caregivers, but nothing has been mentioned about any of the medical facilities, our outlying clinics, or the hospitals. Is there any discussion about doing that?
There is. Actually, what I've been advocating for is a risk factor-based testing strategy. In other words, if you're an individual that works in a hospital or a clinic, or law enforcement with high exposure through traffic, that would be a risk factor-based testing. It's no different than HIV. If IV drugs are used, we probably should consider HIV testing. We're finding something similar here, which in the case of, for example, the mentioned earlier to the journal article that was published in JAMA that looked at the 12.5% positive rate in pregnant women in the hospital. During delivery, that's a risk factor-based testing strategy in that particular instance. I don't foresee it being really any different from healthcare workers or individuals that have high traffic occupations.
Thank you.
Dr. Stahl, I was wondering if you see the point of care antigen testing being useful in the nursing home, in regular screening of healthcare workers, any kind of serial screening situation.
I do, and actually I was thinking about this today. What would be a way, so that antigen test, and it has a reasonably good turnaround time, and maybe what the one of the aspects would be to look at visitors that come in to be able to have at least better assessment of who can safely visit within the nursing home, but still abide by all the other, having a mask, social distancing, all those other things. But at least it would give us more information to lower the risks of introduction of a virus in those facilities.
Yeah, well, and I was wondering, I agree with you, and I've heard it takes 5 to 15 minutes to do. So I think, that somebody could be sitting at the door for that. And I was wondering about that too. It almost seems like a more reliable pre-op test that have everyone sitting out in their cars at 5:30 in the morning, screen them all. The negatives get to come in and have surgery, the positives go somewhere else. And I understand its sensitivity limits, but to me that seems like it would be more reliable than having 72 hours before surgery taking this random point in time PCR test. What do you think about that?
I do think that that's, we could do a PCR test 72 hours prior, and I guess they have to stay in their home and not do anything for the next 72 hours in order to make it, And even then, there's a possibility that the next one at that point in time could actually be positive.
Yeah.
So this one might provide, it might fit that niche that is, it gives us information here and now and the best information that we can get based upon our testing limitations so far.
So do you have, I know you said you were getting some of the processors for that, but what's the availability of the other testing equipment for those tests compared with our PCR tests, and what about expense?
Right. So I can speak to the cost of the machine itself has ranged anywhere between $700 and $1,200. So it's quite reasonable in comparison to, for example, the Abbott ID now. Also, I don't know as far as what the cartridge or the refill, so to speak, on the test itself would be. Or let alone its availability. But that's something that we're waiting to find out as it becomes more. And I know that there are several other companies that are in the process and about to release them very, very soon as well.
Ah, that's really exciting. I mean, when I heard about this last week, because I've been looking for antigen testing. I mean, to me, that just seems really logical. So great. Thank you.
Thanks, Joan, for those questions. Dr. Misty Anderson, our current NDMA president, asks, can you talk about the false positives that were found with the state testing?
I can speak to that. And when we looked at what those possible false positives were, we identified that one of the machines in particular had a negative control turn positive. And when that was found to be the case, we had to backtrace it so that we could find out how many possible samples were infected. So with that, we were able to identify all 82 possible samples that were possibly a false positive, and then we contacted those facilities and retested them. With that, we were able to look at it from multiple perspectives. We went back into the data and looked to see if there was any other time at to which this could have occurred. So the system was since corrected, and we've realized that on some of those platforms, as we've used them much more frequently, the duty cycle to downtime for maintenance had to change. And with that, also looking at it from another perspective, that was when we had ran about 80,000 tests through 77,000 tests through the lab. And statistically speaking, that's relatively exceptional numbers to only have had 82 so far. So we were able to bank those all inconclusive. We went and retested, and we did find out that it likely was a true error on that particular machine and has since been repurposed.
Thank you. Misty, do you have any follow-up for Dr. Stahl?
No, I just was kind of curious because we had heard some of the talk about that. And, you know, I don't think I ever heard the particular numbers, and I heard that it was some nursing homes. So I was just curious.
And those, that batch of tests that came through was related to care facilities. And that was of grave concern to me because I didn't want to have an action be performed on a patient that was a result of a false positive test. So we felt that it was aggressive that we needed to repurpose that machine if there was a possibility that it could cause further problems, which was done.
Sounds good, thanks. Dr. Kumar, you have a question.
Hi, so welcome. I'm a pediatric hospitalist in Bismarck, and I also have some training in public health with like disaster response, and I'm hosting like an international town hall, you know, every week for last 11 weeks. So the doctors in various facilities across the country were talking about testing 100% of the patients reporting to the hospital. But of course, they have a very high prevalence rate in those areas. And they have divided hospitals into two parts. So I was wondering if you have access or if public access to number of what is the prevalence rate in county hospitals in Bismarck, Fargo? That's my first question. And if we don't have an accurate number, do we have any projection about the prevalence or even the incidence? Number two is the denominator that you are using for all this calculations is like a lot of tests are being done on patients. Like I just came back from work and I tested like 8 patients today. So if those patients, they are sent out of town. Some of them go to Sioux Falls, some of them go here. And do only the positive tests get indexed or you also, they contribute to the denominator of the total tested so we can figure out. And lastly, like this testing, like are we anticipating that we will have like walk-in testing? Anybody who wants to go and go do a test, can we ever think of that happening in North Dakota for any person? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for your question, Dr. Kumar. I can speak to several of those points. Looking at the, you know, various sites throughout the state, Cass County probably being one that has a better amount of data when we compare syndromic positivity rate to, for example, asymptomatic positivity rate or long-term care rates. In that county alone, we're seeing about 4% positive in business environments or long-term care. The prevalence in the syndromic population there that's presenting is about 10%. So it does make a difference, and that's what we're finding. To look at numerators and denominators, they're within the medical record or the reporting system with there is a deduplication, so to speak. So for example, if you received 2 tests, it will not repeat that as an incident, although we all know that PCR testing can change at any point in time. You could be negative one day and positive the next. So that's a process that we're looking at because with long-term care testing where it is by and large serialized, which was a program that we developed here in North Dakota with the CDC Epidemic Intelligence Service team to develop a serial point prevalence, as it's referred, where we can identify a number of positives in a long-term care facility. We retest them in a set period of time, and we want to see the number of positives continue to decline as a root cause analysis is performed, isolation, containment, cleaning, all those things. But those repeat tests aren't always counted. So we have individual incidents and the number of tests, and we started reporting that on the website as well. To speak to the last point, there's the push coming now from the CDC with being surveillance testing is possibly going to that route. I do think that We have a great opportunity here in North Dakota where we've got the capability to test. You know, as far as the test goes, it is fully funded. There's no cost to it. And that if we have the ability or people that is deemed appropriate that we need to test them, I think that that's probably something we should do. And that's referred to as the active case finding component, where we identify and isolate early, either in the asymptomatic stage or the presymptomatic stage.
Thank you. That's
all right. Thanks, Dr. Kumar. We have a question from Dr. Stahl with two A's in Fargo, I believe. He asked, surge in COVID, is there a surge in COVID possible after recent demonstrations where little social distancing was done?
Absolutely, I think there is. And this is something that we haven't seen quite to the extent that's been happening in other states. However, in speaking with other individuals throughout the country, that they have seen some slight spikes now, starting today, because since these demonstrations have started, they have now established the proper time period where we will get positive tests. In North Dakota here specifically, we expect there to be a bump, but a small bump, when we plug it into ways to maybe determine how much it will cause an effect. Our estimates right now are 50 to 80 new positives, probably in the next 5 days or so. We're also looking at, if you are going to go and demonstrate, that we should have people there to at least hand out masks as a way to be able to slow the spread in any aspect or another.
Thanks. You know, that makes sense. I also, and I know Joan and I have talked about this a little bit too, is with all the graduation parties, it seems like every weekend we all have all these graduation parties, and I really haven't seen it in the test results that have come out, you know, on the daily test results, but I wondered if you had anything more to add on that one.
So when I first, when the economy was starting to be released after a more strict lockdown, I estimated that it would be about 14 or 15 days before we actually started seeing it reflected in the data. But I was wrong. It was actually 22 days before I started seeing it in the data. And so I don't really know as to point at which I can say that we're going to start seeing that post-graduation bump, or maybe even the demonstration bump. I've been humbled by trying to make these assessments, but I suspect that if we do start seeing, it might actually balance itself out with multiple other effects such as weather, those sorts of things. So it'll be really interesting to see, but it'll also help provide us better information as to how we need to move forward,
I think. I think the only way we can probably ever know is if we see a spike in the hospitalization and the mortality rate, because our testing is still not there where we would like it to be. So that's a number we all will be following very closely to see if all this relaxation of social distancing is having a real impact.
That brings up an excellent point. As we looked at various ways or barometers throughout the state to really make an assessment as to what is happening in those counties and are we missing something, and we feel it is one of the ways we could look at it would be hospital bed occupancy that's related to influenza-like illnesses.
Yeah, actually, I would probably talk to you privately also, but we should really aggressively pursue testing of all patients reporting to the hospitals, because they are seeing some super spreading happening in the hospitals, you know, and so that is the potential for harm is there. And the places where they had like moderate or high prevalence, and now they are moving into high prevalence. So that is one of the best ways to stay ahead of the curve rather than to react ultimately. So we should be working on getting all patients tested, and it will be very reassuring to the providers, but it will mostly fulfill a wider objective of preventing hospitals from being super spreaders. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kumar. Now we have a question from Dr. Luke. How does the Sophia test compare with the Abbott test?
The the Sophia test, as we know it, is the antigen test and the Abbott ID now, which I think is what's being referred to here. If it's the Abbott ID now test being the PCR test, there's multiple ways in which we could approach that. The Abbott ID now test was run off of a platform that has the ability through an update to test for SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. And normally that ID now was purposed to test RSV, influenza, and strep throat. With that, the new update, it had some other concerns because it was coming out with a test that was advertised to be a point of care test. And what we've learned about it is it's point of care like, but probably not quite point of care due to safety issues. It is not exactly the cleanest way to run the test. There's concerns about spilling and there's concerns about aerosolization. Such to the point that the IHS, as well as the VA nationally, decided that it had to be in a biosafety level 2 hood in order for it to be ran due to those concerns. Additionally, when it was ran against other platforms for identifying its sensitivity and specificity as controls, it was found that it had a fairly high false positive rate. In other words, to use it from a clinical standpoint, if you were tested on it and you tested positive, you likely have it. But if you tested negative and there's still high index of clinical suspicion, you should probably have that individual tested or retested on an alternative platform. The antigen testing I can't speak so much about now, but hopefully when we get them in, we'll be able to have more data and be able to provide recommendations on how to best employ it.
Sounds good. Thank you, Dr. Stahl. Dr. Jane Winston asks, can you speak to the idea to start reopening elderly congregate living facilities? Follow CMS guidelines, or what do you see there?
Right, so one advantage, I'll say that in North Dakota, we developed the VP3 plan in conjunction with the Department of Human Services, and we developed a task force to be able to test these facilities. We are one of 5 states in the nation right now, and that's actually, we were the first state in the nation to be able to test all long-term care facilities in the state of North Dakota. And to also go beyond that, our outcomes here have been exceptional when we compare them nationally. Our guidelines for reopening are based upon local prevalence levels, as well as how that facility has done with infection control and what their pandemic plan really is. We are opening them up now, or at least allowing the facility to make their own assessment as to whether or not they want to continue to have more stringent policies in place. We are going to look at more creative solutions as well, so that we can balance family needs with exposure risk. And I think that therein lies the big challenge. But at the same time, we have some unique programs that are coming out both financially and care-wise that are being ran primarily through DHS, as to which we're working closely with to find out what the best answer is, because it's going to be different from each facility, and it's going to be different from the east part of the state versus the west part of the state, as we're learning based upon prevalence numbers as well.
All right. Thank you very much. I know that there's a lot of people, including Joan. I know her mother lives in a long-term care facility, and so people are very interested in that. Opening it up again for any questions. I saw a hand raised, but I think we answered that. Dr. Winston had typed it in.
Dr. Stahl, can I ask what you think about our level of PPE? If we do have a second surge?
Right, so I think by second surge, probably of the fall timeframe, I am very concerned about a second surge. I don't think it's gonna be a matter of if, it's probably gonna be a matter of when. And I'll speak to 2 points to that just real quick. campuses are going to go back to school in August, and we're going to have probably between 30 and 45,000 people all back into a campus environment. And that's just higher university systems. That's not including, you know, the local public schools or that sort of thing. And I don't think that we'll have a effective vaccine or an effective treatment that will be able to be administered on an outpatient basis by August. That's the first point. So population is the density, such as campuses and schools, is gonna be an issue. And then to speak to that regarding the requirements, when we have that, looking with possible co-infection with influenza, for example, we are going to deal with significant issues. And when I look at what the possibilities of that are, worst case scenario, if we do everything right the second time, we'll still probably have a peak infection that's going to be 3 or 4 times higher than what we have now. So it will put concern for stress on the system, but also the preparation aspect. Right now, we have adequate levels of PPE to deal with this scenario at this level. But that might not necessarily be the case in the fall, as to which the Battelle system was also brought on so that we can, you know, have more unique solutions when it comes to that.
Thank you. Dr. Stephanie Jallon asks, is there a plan in place for dealing for the unexpected bump in mental health decompensation of our population over the coming months?
Yeah, so we work closely with DHS regarding this, and there is going to be likely changes moving forward, particularly with grants and funding available. And we're working closely with DHS department to make sure that we're prepared, because this has had already a heavy impact mentally on many people, and it's going to be there again when it comes back, if it comes back, and we'll have to all work with that.
Dr. Jallon, you had a follow-up. Let's see here.
Hey, Courtney, while you're looking at that, can I just say, I'm just wondering if maybe you can think of any ideas for the Department of Health to help healthcare organizations in North Dakota increase their savvy and their efficiency of telehealth services in preparation for this, in this calm before the storm. And I ask that because I'm hearing facilities, including my own, while I'm trying to optimize my telehealth capacity, everybody else is, we're wide open. And I'm sitting there thinking, why aren't you using this time to figure out how to do telehealth better? Because that's where we're going to be next fall and winter. So have you heard of any toolkits or incentives, or do you have any ideas? Because I'm very concerned about this.
Are you asking me, Joan, or Dr. Stahl?
Everybody, I guess. I was directing to Dr. Stahl because he's our boss now, but I'm really opening it up. I was involved in this call. We have asthma clinic that we do for kids in our region, and we haven't missed a clinic. We converted to teleclinic in April, and every month that we do it, we have 2 clinics a month. Every month it gets stronger and better and more comprehensive. I can't wait to see what it is this fall when we really need it. And every step of the way, I keep looking behind my back thinking, gosh, maybe I should just do this. The prevalence is low. The likelihood of seeing these patients is low, but I feel like obsessively driven to optimize this telehealth format.
That is true. I can tell you, when I was working with the VA, telehealth was essentially becoming a new standard. And particularly since about mid-February and into March, it was heavily used. And about half of the patient visits that I had done was via telehealth. Some of them, of course, you can't do in that regard. But it is probably going to be here at least until we have immunizations and or an effective ambulatory treatment that we can use. But I foresee the expansion of it, and it's going to require some creative solutions as well.
And then Dr. Stahl, to that end, we have this quirky law in North Dakota where we have a parity, which if you're not studying it, you think, great, reimbursement is equal. But the truth is, what that really means is if insurance reimburses for a live visit, they have to reimburse for a televisit, but it does not have to be the same dollar amount. So I'm finding when I do a telehealth visit really well, it takes a long time because I don't have my stethoscope. So I feel like, man, I should be compensated at least equally for this service. So maybe I don't want to ask you because it's your third day on the job. I guess this is really to inform you that maybe we should be thinking about that for the next legislative session. Thanks.
No, I do. I think that's something that we'll have to look at because this could be setting a new standard as we move forward into the unknown.
Yeah, just so you know, it's pretty even with.
Telehealth is actually going into a lot of problems in the East Coast. Like some insurance companies are saying that as the hospitals are returning to full function, they will not be paying for telehealth. Reimbursement continues to be very low. There is a lot of concerns that this probably would never be addressed and can never be fixed because insurance companies just want to pay less. So there will be telehealth, but it's not that big magic bullet that we all thought it would be. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Dr. Kumar. And I just wanted to add, I have a question here in the queue too about we sent a letter in early April. We joined with a number of groups on payment parity for telemedicine, and we didn't get any movement on it. I had heard that the insurance commissioner was not in favor of it, and I think Governor Burgum was deferring decisions on that issue to him. But yes, it's going to be an issue moving forward into the legislative session. Other states have payment parity. We do not. And so it's just going to be something that we'll have to review and study carefully moving forward. And of course, keep Dr. Stahl in the loop and in on the discussions, because I don't think I get very concerned about the surge being 3 to 4 times more higher. That's very concerning over the winter time. And so that's going to be a top issue. I'm going to go to Dr. Schatz. Dr. Schatz from Jamestown asks, what do you foresee testing to be like going back to school in the fall? Lots of kids will need testing.
Yes, that's something that we're looking at and trying to find out what would be the best way to, for lack of a better term, tackle that problem. We're thinking about even innovative ideas such as taking a Hologic Panther and putting it in the back of a truck with a testing team and going to different sites to test. That particularly would be something for larger school systems or university systems, but we are prepared to increase our capacity to absorb that, particularly as we go to a second wave. But yes, long story short, lots of people are going to need testing. And we're going to have to figure out a way to address it.
Well, very good. Thank you. Dr. Jalen, I'm going to try to, did you have a follow-up question to, I've tried to unmute you. I think you need to unmute yourself if you want to follow up with your comments about DHS.
Yeah, I just didn't want to interrupt Joan, but I was like, I'm an employee of DHS and there's zero information being disseminated to the employees about that plan that you that you guys are working on?
Right now, the funding stream is being created federally. And we're looking at the best way as to which we can speak to it. That was between myself and Chris.
Sounds good. We will look forward to that, and we'll want to make sure we let everybody know. We've got a question from Dr. Shah. It's a follow-up to kind of related issue, saying that it's her understanding that the reimbursement for Medicaid patients needing behavioral therapy via video has not been great. And I know that when I was doing some research on telemedicine parity, I had heard from one of my psychiatrists that the psychiatry reimbursement was basically parity from all the payers. But I think behavior therapy is perhaps a different type of provider. But I don't know if Dr. Stahl, if you want to comment on that.
I don't have anything as far as the behavioral therapy component goes. I'd have to research that and find a better answer.
Okay, I'm going to unmute Dr. Schatz and see if... Dr. Schatz, did you want to explain a little bit more?
Well, you know, so we've got patients who are needing, you know, therapy, talk therapy. They need to see their psychologists and their counselors, and they're doing it over video. And before, Medicaid was apparently paying for whatever they were, I don't know exactly what they were, how that was working, but they went from getting coverage to now it's, you know, $100, they don't get any coverage or something, you know, and these folks really need that therapy in order to, I mean, especially in COVID times. And what's nice for them is that some people do so much better with a video session, because coming to the clinic is anxiety provoking. And I just am concerned there's a lot of our Medicaid population that is not going to be able to afford continuing the treatment they need with their psychologist and therapist.
Yeah. Do we have any, or has there been any preliminary data to support the outcomes difference?
I'm not aware, but I just, in my clinic, I have heard of problems with basically we're being denied any payment, and it's all going to fall on the patients. So, but I'm in family medicine. I'm kind of not an expert.
This is Steph Jolin. I've had kids that whose parents are saying that Medicaid is denying them, so their kids have not been attending any of their therapies during this as well. And I see mental health 100%.
And what is very interesting is even certified diabetic educators are not getting paid for telehealth visits. My type 1 diabetes patients and CDEs contribute such a lot, and they're also not. Nutritionist is getting paid, but not the CDEs. Thank you.
I will try to, Dr. Schatz and Dr. Jalen, I'll follow up with you offline, and so then maybe connect you with Medicaid, because I think Medicaid has been trying to make an effort. They did a presentation today to the legislature trying to outline all that they're doing for behavioral health, and trying to facilitate e-visits and telehealth. So I will follow up with both of you about that and try to get you connected with Caprice.
Well, and I will just say that reading through the Medicaid telehealth policies and speaking to Caprice Knapp, and I think that, Courtney, you were there for that too. I mean, she says that they're paying at parity. So I think maybe you guys should send some specifics about this to Caprice, because I think there's something wrong. Something's wrong here, and it's not jiving with their policies.
Right. All right. A very productive discussion. I think we've answered all our questions and all our hand raised. I think we've got them all. And we're right on the hour here. And so I just would like to extend a special thank you to Dr. Stahl, our guest. Very impressive presentation. We look forward to working with you. Please let us know if there's anything that we can do to help you. Any information you'd like disseminated, we send our e-physician. I think we'll make sure we put you on the list and probably hit you up for membership too. So thank you very much. And thanks again, Joan, and Mike. Thanks for being here.
Thanks all for right. having us.
We'll see you next week, and we've got Tim Weidrich on the agenda, I think, and we're still looking, so if you have any ideas, please let me know. So thanks, everyone, for attending. Bye-bye.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.